I'd like to begin by reading two texts this morning. They are related, as you will see. Firstly, in Galatians chapter 6, verse 7. Galatians 6, verse 7. Be not deceived. God is not mocked. For whatsoever a man soweth, that shall he also reap. Then from Genesis chapter 29 and verse 23. And it came to pass in the evening that Laban took Leah his daughter and brought her to him, to Jacob. And our subject this morning is the deceiver deceived. Well, Jacob leaves Bethel with a spring in his step. Literally, that's the picture, the language of the opening words of this chapter. Jacob went on his way. If you have a margin, you'll see it reads, he lifted up his feet. He had what we would say in English, a spring in his step. Despite his sin and his deceit of his own father, having alienated his brother Esau, having fled the family home, he learned at Bethel of God's forgiving love and great purpose toward him and his future family. He's given wonderful assurances of God's future care and protection. And he's given that promise that he will be ancestor to the coming Messiah. No wonder he went forward in faith and confidence, despite the reality of his new situation. He's still Jacob. He's still on the run from a threatening brother. And he still has hundreds of miles to go before he comes to the land of Syria and to Haran itself. God's faithfulness is soon confirmed to him. The hand of providence goes before him. He comes to Rebekah, his mother's ancestral home. He's been charged by his father Isaac, probably under inspiration of God, to go there and to seek a wife. And at Haran, he is soon introduced to Rachel. It must have been an emotional time, having been preserved through that long and arduous and somewhat perilous journey. He now comes to family. And he sees the hand of the Lord going before him. This was not a chance meeting. He knew that God had ordered his steps. In one sense, if we are the Lord's people, there is no such thing as a chance meeting. The Lord does go before his people. All things do work together for good to them who love God, who are the called according to his purpose. But Jacob has begun a new chapter in his life. He enters this town, Haran, as a converted man, favored with God, heir to special promises, first given to his grandfather Abraham. But Jacob, despite those rich blessings of salvation and the assurances of heaven, is not yet the finished article. And despite that assurance he has that God will be with him, the next years will be far from plain sailing for this new born-again soul, Jacob. God's love will be displayed in fatherly chastisement. He's still Jacob. He's still a man who has grievously sinned. And the refining of his character is going to take place over these years in the household of Laban. And those lessons that he learned will also be instructive to us this morning. Almost 100 years earlier, Abraham's servant Eliezer had made a similar journey in order to obtain a wife for his master's son, Isaac. How different was the journey that he made. He came with camels, with jewelry, with a great status, and all the status symbols that go with it. He sought a wife for Isaac, and he was able to endow both Rebekah and her family with many gifts. But Jacob comes on a similar errand, but he has but a staff in his hand. He comes on foot, a man who has had to flee his own family home. Well, Jacob arrives. It's telling, perhaps, as some have pointed out, that when Jacob arrives at the well, unlike his grandfather's servant, Eliezer, there's no record of a prayer seeking God's confirming and guiding will. We might argue that Jacob, though he is now, we might say, a young Christian, he's not yet the finished article. He was a new man in the Lord, but he has forgotten something elementary at this key juncture. Now, it could be said that Jacob did pray, but his prayer is not recorded. Eliezer's was. So let me suggest this lesson to us all, particularly to those of us who are young Christians. We may be new, and we may know a great change has taken place in our lives by the grace of God, but we may still make elementary mistakes as young Christians. And Jacob certainly did, not doing the basics when he should. Are we checking our decisions by resorting to the word of God? Are we alert to his guiding hand? Are we letting our hearts run ahead of our heads in the great decisions of life? Are we seeking the Lord's guiding hand sincerely, saying, Lord, prevent some foolish step. Assure me that I am in thy good and perfect will in those steps that I take. Well, Jacob arrives at the well, and he encounters what would appear to be some lazy shepherd boys. It's the middle of the day, as it will be demonstrated as this chapter and the following chapters unfold. Jacob is an expert shepherd. That's what his family have been for years. And he sees these shepherd boys, they're all huddled around this well, but they're not watering the sheep. And so, in a rather respectful manner, he challenges them and says, what's the problem? Were they simply lazy? Not really caring for the sheep? Happy all to be together? Oh, they say, we have to wait until all the sheep are gathered. Then we take the stone away. Perhaps these were young boys, they couldn't move the stone. But they tell Jacob, Rachel is coming. Perhaps that is why Jacob was rather keen to get their sheep watered and moved on, so that he could interview Rachel alone, his cousin. We may not know, but it's an intriguing set of verses that record this encounter. Well, Rachel comes, he's welcomed by Rachel and then by Laban. But he will discover as the chapter unfolds that Laban is more than a match for his own previous deceit. Laban must have been aware of Abraham's wealth from Eliezer's previous visit. He would be aware too of those great promises made to Abraham and his family of future blessing and great advantage, and above all, the promise of a great Messiah, deliverer. But when Jacob comes as an empty-handed man, he must have been somewhat perplexed. Verse 13 tells us that Jacob gave to Laban's family an update. He told him all these things. Well, what are these things? We may limit it just to what he told Rachel earlier. Doubtless, much more was said. Laban would have been filled with questions regarding his sister, Rebekah, and the household of Isaac. Jacob would have had to explain why he had come alone and in relative poverty. Perhaps he told Laban and Rachel of his dream on the journey. Well, Laban was initially warm and hospitable, but he must have had mixed thoughts. If this is the family of Abraham, if this is the son and heir to God's great blessing, then what's he doing here as a destitute individual in need of a roof over his head? Perhaps he was somewhat disappointed, bewildered. It's clear that as the chapter unfolds, Laban is a man who only measures things by earthly advantages. He wants prosperity, earthly prosperity, and he's prepared to take advantage of Jacob's skill as a shepherd. He recognizes his worth to him. And so, in order to secure his long-term stay, he says, well, you must be rewarded. What will your wages be? Did he sense that there was a growing romance between Jacob and Rachel? It's possible. Anyway, as you will see from the passage, Jacob names his price. 7 years service for Rachel's hand in marriage. Now, some have said Jacob here ought to have been more confident in the promise of God to provide for him and to go before him. He should have held his head up high and said, I've come for one of your daughters as my wife. But Jacob was humble enough to know that he had no dowry to give. He had but a staff in his hand, as he would later refer to. And so he offers to serve Laban for 7 years. What are the lessons then that we can learn from this chapter? I'm going to draw three lessons, and there are many more, but three key lessons from this chapter. And the first, and perhaps the most significant, is that we reap what we sow. And Jacob in this chapter would reap what he had previously sown in his former life. God may forgive our sin, as he had Jacob's, but he often allows us to bear the earthly consequences of our previous sin. The scars The consequences of our foolish behavior often remain with us. Often they revisit us. God is merciful. God is tender. But God's law has to be honored. And the wisdom of his commandments is often vindicated by the sorrows that we experience on account of our previous foolish ways. Jacob knew that there had been a great promise given before his birth to Rebekah concerning him and Esau. The elder shall serve the younger. But Jacob in this chapter is going to be chastened for trying to obtain that promise in impatience and deceit. He had deceived his own father. He wanted that promise. I want everyone to serve me. But what do we read here concerning Jacob? He said, I will serve you, Laban, 7 years for Rachel. He had to serve. The prophet Hosea draws attention to this fact in chapter 12, verse 12. We may touch on it later. But here is the man who inherited the promise. How humbling for him to have to serve for a wife 7 years, in fact, 14 years, because he would be deceived. God is not to be mocked, brothers and sisters, young people. We may think that we can sin and get away with it, but often the wheels of God's providence grind very slowly. And those former sins, which God may have forgiven, we still have to reap the bitter fruit of those things that we have done in our past life. He deceived his father. How did he deceive his father? He pretended to be the elder son. This was payback time. He was going to be deceived. He thought he was marrying the younger daughter. But he was given the elder daughter. Tit for tat. We shouldn't say that, because God doesn't do tit for tat. But there are times when the Lord causes us to be chastened on account of our former sins. Why does he do that? So that we will loathe the very sins that we once committed so brazenly and so freely. He wants us to look back and say how foolish I was to think that that would lead to blessing, to happiness, to fulfillment, to ease and contentment. I see now that those very sins have been to great damage in my life and perhaps in the life of those that are nearest and dearest to me. Imagine the scene here in verse 23. Laban takes his elder daughter, Leah. She is brought in the darkness, veiled almost certainly, as the custom was, to Jacob. Rachel knew what was happening, surely. Leah knew what was happening, but Jacob didn't. How painful this must have been for Rachel. And yet, in some way, her authoritarian father prevented any protest. Probably Leah had a secret love for Jacob and was willing to go along with this deceitful plot. But what a shock. What horror, what dismay must have filled Jacob's mind when he awoke in the morning light and discovered it was Leah who had been given to him in marriage the evening before. In Job 4 verse 8, we read, even as I have seen, they that plough iniquity and so wickedness reap the same. A.W. Pink very helpfully expands this principle and shows how often the Lord, so in his providence, arranged things in the lives of individuals that they would sow what they reap. What did Pharaoh proclaim should happen to the Hebrew boys, the newborn boys? Where were they to be thrown? Drowned in the Nile. Where did Pharaoh meet his fate? Drowned in the Nile. There was a wicked king called Adoni-Bezek in Judges chapter 1, verses 6 and 7. It was said of him that when he was arrested by the Israelites, they cut off his thumbs and his big toes. And he confesses, perhaps we should turn to it, Judges chapter 1, verse 6. He said, 70 kings, having their thumbs and their great toes cut off, gathered their meat under my table. As I have done, so God hath requited me. He acknowledged that his former sins had been visited upon him. What about believers? We read of Asa, that there was a time when he was a good king, but the prophet Hanani came to him and said unto him, because thou hast relied on the king of Syria and not relied on the Lord thy God, therefore is the host of the king of Assyria escaped out of thine hand. For the eyes of the Lord run to and fro throughout all the earth, to show himself strong in the behalf of them whose heart is perfect toward him. Herein thou hast done foolishly. Therefore, from henceforth thou shalt have wars. Then Asa was wroth with the seer, and put him in a prison house, for he was in a rage with him because of this thing. Where it says there, the prison house, it actually means the stocks in the prison. That's the literal Hebrew. His feet were put in the stocks. Here was godly Asa, offended by the honesty of the prophet. And he lost his temper, put him in the prison house with his feet in the stocks. What do we read in the next verse? Asa, behold the acts of Asa first and last. Lo, they are written in the book of the kings of Judah and Israel. And Asa, in the 39th year of his reign, was diseased in his feet, until his disease was exceeding great. The Lord reminded him, what did you do to that prophet? You put his feet in the stocks. You will have a disease in your feet. Paul approved the stoning of Stephen. And yet Paul also had to experience stoning himself. Jacob would use clothes, Esau's clothes, in order to fool his own father. His sons would later take the coat of Joseph, dipped in blood, to deceive their own father Jacob concerning the fate, presumed at least, of Joseph. The scriptures make clear that what we sow, God often sees to it that we will reap. We must then beware our own besetting sins. If we are his children, God has forgiven us. We will never suffer eternal punishment for them. But God, in his fatherly wisdom, may appoint that we learn the bitterness of those sins in a chastening, humbling way in our own life. Were we once rebellious? Were we given to some vice or some lusts? The Lord may cause us to suffer the painful and bitter fruit of them. I remember a Christian brother some years ago. He was a dear friend, but in his early life, he had been very rebellious against the things of God. He was a drinker, a smoker. He was despising of all the things of Christ. After he was saved, he had to watch his own sons go astray into the very sins that he had once indulged in himself. And he used to say to me, "I cannot complain at the sorrow that God has caused me to see when I see my sons going astray, because I once did the same." God has every right to remind me of the bitterness and the folly of my former ways. Are we following a materialistic lifestyle as believers? Beware. These verses tell us what we sow, we may reap in some way. It may be that our children follow our ways, but worse, to our greater grief. Are we half-hearted in our worship of God? Not consistent in our attendance at his house, hardly ever reading and praying with our families? It may be that the Lord will see to it that we reap for those spiritual neglect that we have yielded to. Are we casual in our Sabbath keeping? Not really taking the fourth commandment seriously? Then we may be sowing seeds that in later life give us much sorrow. Our children may not take seriously our reverence for God if they see that we are half-hearted. So there's the first lesson. It was a painful lesson. It's a stark lesson to see how Jacob's former sins come back in the purposes of God to haunt him. But secondly, on a more positive note, Jacob here, in this period of 20 odd years, it's a period of training in the school of God. He arrived in Haran as a newborn soul, but he had much to learn. Isn't it true in Scripture that God not only forgives, he also renews his children in his likeness? God not only justifies us from our guilt, he sanctifies us from our sinful ways. And that's what's happening to Jacob here over these years. He had acted impatiently in trying to grab the blessing. He had sincere motives, but he acted in a deceitful way. And now Jacob must learn patience. Jacob, you're going to have the promise of being the father of a great nation. You're going to be heir to the ancestor to the Messiah himself. But you're going to have to wait. He has to serve Laban 7 years. We read in Hosea 12, I referred to it earlier. We read, Jacob fled into the country of Syria, and Israel served for a wife, and for a wife he kept sheep. The implication there is it was a humbling experience for this privileged individual. He has to wait for Rachel. These were so formative to his character in so many ways. And so let's notice here that Jacob does not complain. He has God's promise. By faith and in confidence, he's willing to serve. Doubtless he cries out in anguish when Laban interferes and deceives him. But he's actually very humble. He's very patient. And he perseveres. Often, brothers and sisters, it's in those times of hardship that God does most to shape our characters in his likeness. The way may be painful. It may be humbling, even humiliating. It may bring us to a point where, naturally speaking, we know every sort of emotion that we would rather never experience. They must have all come flooding into Jacob's thought and consciousness when he was being so cruelly manipulated by his future father-in-law. But how they would have shaped him. They would have brought him from that self-confident and devious young man that he once was to being wholly dependent upon the faithfulness of God who had revealed himself to him. Laban clearly is a selfish man, and he intends to profit from Jacob. If I give him the elder daughter, he'll have to serve another 7 years for the younger. But lastly, thirdly, this chapter teaches us the wisdom of God's laws. Particularly when it comes to marriage. But we can broaden this principle out. Jacob would have been content, I'm sure, with Rachel alone. That's what he intended. To be like his father, Isaac, who had but one woman as his wife. It's easy for us to be tempted to be hard on Jacob for his polygamy. But we need to remember, firstly, that it was almost forced upon him. He had little choice. What was he to do? Was he to refuse Leah? He probably would have never had Rachel if he had. He lived in culturally different days, where polygamy was more accepted by society. Nevertheless, it was a sin. It was wrong. It was against God's express revelation, given at the time when Adam and Eve were first brought together in marriage. Yes, this was before God had reiterated to Moses that marriage was between one man and one woman. But it was a sinful situation. We cannot escape or excuse that. And how bitter were the consequences? What rivalries it led to between those two sisters, two wives of the same man. What feuds arose between those boys of four different women? It speaks loud and clear to us that when we depart from God's standards, there will be painful consequences. Society has departed from God's standards. People no longer marry. Marriage is being distorted. The whole promotion of the promiscuous society and now transgenderism. These are the abandoning of God's standards. And what will be the consequences? We already see them. Children born out of wedlock. A mental health tsunami. People with twisted psyches. So often these things can be traced back to man's departure from God's explicit commands. The law of God is holy and just and good, says the Apostle Paul. And when we ignore God's commandments and God's standards, it always brings problems. People complain that there's many problems in the world and they blame God. But that's to blame the very opposite of where the problems really lie. The problem is man. The problem is rebellious society. Jacob would have to learn the hard way that when we depart from God's standards, we invite trouble and sorrow and bitterness. Well, think of God's commandments. The Lord's Day has been rejected by our society. It leads to health problems. But more than that, it leads to a demise of true spirituality. If we ignore the commands of God as a church, then it will take its toll upon the health and the testimony of the church and its members. The command to honour father and mother should be extended further. It includes the respect for all authority. Yet we see in our society that respect for authority is being undermined. Brothers and sisters, let this never be true amongst us as a church. We honour as children our parents. We honour as believers, those whom the Lord has set over us, in society, in the church. These things are God's way. And when every man does what is right in his own eyes, it leads to folly, confusion, and sadness. Well, we must draw to a conclusion this morning. This is not a chapter that I looked forward to preaching from. There was quite a temptation just to skim over it and move on to something more wholesome. But it's here because God intends us to learn from it. Beware that we do not sow to ourselves a bitter harvest in later life. Let us learn that when God forgives, he will also sanctify us. And he may even chasten us for those specific sins we have been guilty of, such that we come to loathe them and acknowledge the folly of them. Let us remember to keep close to the commands of Christ, because if we neglect them, we will be the losers. If we keep them, says the scripture, in keeping his commands, there is great reward. And may God bless his word to us. We close.